President Eisenhower's program of federal aid in public and private housing, including a liberalization of loan guarantees on home repair projects, was passed by the Senate late this afternoon by a voice vote, and it was essentially in the form as requested by him and his White House advisors. It was more of the housing program that he had laid out for Congress than it was in the form in which it passed the House of Representatives, chiefly in the matter of the public housing provisions, which the House had eliminated entirely. The public housing program called for 140,000 units of low-cost public housing over a period of 4 years, the exact specifications recommended by the president, part of which are to be slum clearance, the rest housing for congested areas. There were repercussions from the Southern Democrats from the anti-segregation decision of the Supreme Court last week, which you may reliably expect to be a standard pattern in all legislation of this kind from here on. Along with the Supreme Court decision on segregation in the schools, the courts handed down on the same day a ruling on another case in which it said that the federal government also cannot enforce segregation in any federal housing projects. Because of this, under the leadership of Senator Burnett Maybank of South Carolina, the Southerners attempted to knock out of the bill the entire section on public housing. Up until the time of the Supreme Court decision, Senator Maybank had been one of the most aggressive supporters of the federal housing program. On that point, there was a roll call vote, and the result was 66 to 16. 12 of the 16 no's were Democrats. The other three consisted of Republicans Langer of New York and Irving Ives of New York and Langer of North Dakota, and there was independent Senator Wayne Morse of Oregon. That does not add out to four. Will someone here check that for me and find out who the other Republican was? 12 of the 16 were Democrats. There were four others, of which one was Senator Wayne Morse of Oregon, the independent, and there were three Republicans, two of them being Langer of North Dakota and Ives of New York, and we'll have the other one for you presently. The essential features of the president's housing program are a general liberalization of the terms under which the government will insure mortgages, thus loosening up housing credit generally, and it places increased emphasis on the general broad field of do-it-yourself programs for the home. Not necessarily do-it-yourself in the literal sense of the words, but home repair and modernization work in general. The bill now goes back to the House of Representatives for approval of the public housing program on which the two houses have disagreed, and a compromise will have to be worked out on that point. That produces an interesting question and one that bears careful watching. The House turned down the federal housing program before the Supreme Court decision, segregation decision, was handed down 2 months ago on April the 2nd, to be exact, did so because it disapproved of the public housing program as such, as a matter of principle. If the Southern Democrats are able to turn the issue into a question of segregation on this second go-round, however, and turn against it en masse because of the Supreme Court decision, they might well turn many of the representatives from other parts of the country who were opposed to public housing on principle in favor of it, rather than to appear to be voting along with the segregationists. And the proportionate strength of the true Southern conservative Democrats in the House of Representatives is even smaller than it is in the Senate. On their own, they could command not more than 60 or 80 votes, far less than the number needed to keep the public housing provisions out of the bill. It's just an illustration of how crazily the currents of political force can run, particularly when emotional issues are involved. Well, we've straightened out the matter of the vote on the housing provision. There were 13 of the 16 who were Democrats, and so the other non-Democrats were Senator Wayne Morse, independent of Oregon, Langer of North Dakota, and Ives of New York, Republicans. President Eisenhower finds himself tonight face-to-face with a new problem of holdovers from the previous administration, this time involving the highly critical Atomic Energy Commission and the administration thereof, and reaching very definitely into the case of Dr. J. Robert Oppenheimer and his security status with the government. The immediate manifestation of the problem, as it came today, was in the course of hearings before the Joint Congressional Committee on Atomic Energy, which is considering a bill to make numerous technical and administrative changes in the basic atomic energy law of 1946, under which the commission has been operating since that time. Among the changes as recommended by the administration is a provision which makes the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission its principal officer, in quotes, as against his present status, which is little more than that of a member of the overall five-man commission, except that he presides over meetings of the commission from a parliamentary standpoint. In virtually every other independent commission in government, incidentally, the chairman is what amounts to the administrative officer. The proposal was to make the same condition apply in the AEC. The present chairman is Mr. Louis Strauss, an appointee of the Eisenhower administration, a very distinguished gentleman, formerly a Republican member of the commission, close personal friend and one-time assistant to Mr. Herbert Hoover, a very brilliant mind, generally credited with having devised and put into effect the detection system by which it was possible for us to know that the Russians had detonated their several atomic explosions. He's also a man, the man who was responsible over widespread opposition within the commission, particularly on the part of Dr. Oppenheimer, for going ahead with the development of the hydrogen bomb. He is widely, thoroughly, cordially disliked by the left-wing and liberal elements. In the course of these hearings today, there went into the record a statement by three members of the commission opposing the change in the status of Chairman Strauss, Strauss he calls himself, on the ground that it would tend to produce a one-man commission. The important and all interesting and interesting fact lies in the matter of who the three members were who supported this thesis. All holdovers from the Truman administration, two of them registered Democrats, Thomas E. Murray and Eugene M. Zuckert, and a third, a purported nonpartisan, Henry D. Smythe, himself a physicist and spokesman for that portion of the scientific fraternity that supports Dr. Oppenheimer. Zuckert was an assistant secretary of air under President Truman. Chairman Strauss and the fifth and remaining member of the commission are in favor of the changes, but they are in the minority. Of course, this document today is not binding on the congressional committee at all, but was purely an expression of opinion as among members of the Atomic Energy Commission. It does, however, represent a majority opinion of the present commission makeup and shows the atmosphere there. And therein lies the involvement of the Oppenheimer case in the decision that has just been handed down by the Special Security Board recommending that Dr. Oppenheimer not be given back his former top secret Q clearance or, for that matter, any security clearance at all. He held the Q clearance, of course, during the years that he headed the Los Alamos development during the war, and continued to hold it until President Eisenhower took it away from him last December and ordered the special inquiry. The tie-in is something you never notice unless you're familiar with government security routine, particularly the routine of the Atomic Energy Commission. You probably paid little attention to the fact that Oppenheimer's attorneys announced that they were waiving their right to an appeal to the Personnel Security Review Board, which normally is the next step up the ladder in security cases, and instead was asking for an immediate and direct appeal to the Atomic Energy Commission itself, which in the normal procedure would be the second step up the ladder. And the reason for that abnormal proposal will become somewhat more obvious to you when I explain that the term of one of the three holdovers on the commission, Commissioner Zuckert, expires on the last day of this month, and he will be replaced by a new Eisenhower appointee. Thus, if Dr. Oppenheimer can get his appeal heard and disposed of by the commission before the end of this month, June 30th, the court will be the same group which showed its hand today in the statement opposing the administration's reorganization bill. Two fair deal appointees who are registered Democrats bitterly opposed Chairman Strauss and the physicist Smythe, who is spokesman for that faction of the scientific world that has been sounding off in every direction in support of Dr. Oppenheimer. By going through the usual routine, the handling by the Security Review Board, it would have taken so much time that the Stack Commission would be out of existence and Dr. Oppenheimer would have had to take his chances with Zuckert's successor as the balance of commission power. The final neat twist of the situation, however, is that the decision as to whether or not this appeal may go direct to the commission lies where? With the commission itself. The commission as now constituted with a 3-2 balance on the pro-Oppenheimer side. So watch carefully and see what happens when that decision is made. Most significant development in the Army-McCarthy hearings today concerned a character by the name of Theodore Kagan, who was the principal subject of investigation by McCarthy Committee Counsel Roy Cohn and his assistant G. David Chine as the Director of Information Services in Europe at the time the two investigators made their badly publicized trip to Germany. Kagan had some 4,000 employees under him at the time, and as a result of the Cohn-Shine investigations and the information they brought back to this country, plus their disclosures about his pro-communist leanings, he's the one who wrote the plays produced by communist front organizations, resigned his job and came back to the United States. I say as a result of, let's correct that, to say that he resigned after their investigations. The final attack on Cohn and Shine, particularly after Shine was inducted into the armed services, the original series of scurrilous stories of attack about his supposed special privilege at Fort Dix and his work with the committee and his passes to permit that work, were inspired and published as a special exclusive expose by the New York Post, the left-wing rag of which former communist James Wechsler is the editor. It was brought out in the hearings today that after Theodore Kagan left the government and came back to this country, he was given a job on the staff of, guess what, the New York Post, where he still is employed at the present time. They never say die, do they? Suppress them here, they bob up later somewhere else. I'll be back in just a moment. A Belgian cargo plane was fired upon today as it flew over the Yugoslav border, and one of the Belgian crew members was killed. The British Embassy in Vienna, Austria, made the announcement after the plane, with its fuselage ripped by the bullets, made an emergency landing at Graz, also in Austria, but in the British zone. The Belgian plane was en route from England to Yugoslavia when the attack was made, carrying cargo and a regular run for the Sabena airline. That's the top of the news as it looks from here.
Ladies and gentlemen, 10 million Americans bring you Frank Edwards and the news. Mr. Edwards is sponsored by the 10 million men and women who make up the American Federation of Labor.
Good evening, Washington. The government finally admits that our economy is in trouble. The United States Department of Commerce reveals tonight that personal incomes of all Americans dropped again in April for the sixth month in a row. The income rate fell at a rate of $1 billion per year below March, and $5 billion annually below last October's rate of income. Hardest hit by the decline were farmhands and persons employed in metalworking plants. Mr. Sinclair Weeks, the Secretary of Commerce, said today, and I quote him, "We are going to come out of this recession." You may recall that Mr. Weeks is the same gentleman who said recently that anyone who talked about a recession now was a prophet of gloom and doom. For many months, I've been reporting to you on the steady decline in American prosperity, not because such reporting was pleasant, but because it was very important. Now that decline has reached a point where even the happiness boys must admit it, and at long last, they may quit trying to kid the public and get down to business. Hanoi, Indochina. Swarms of communist troops continue to pour into the fighting zone, overrunning one French strong point after another and upsetting the French supply routes. Washington Special. Not generally known is this fact. French draftees can refuse to serve in Indochina, which makes the manpower problem there acute for the embattled French. Everywhere, USA. Whatever became of the widely advertised peace talks for settling the war in Korea? Thus far, nothing has happened except more official silence. We dare not leave South Korea until the thing is settled, and it is not being settled. Not yet. Rio de Janeiro. As predicted to you, the president of Brazil today issued an order fixing prices on Brazil's forthcoming 1954 coffee crop. The new price is 87 cents per pound at Santos, which means that raw coffee will cost about 90 cents per pound wholesale at the New York docks. For an explanation of what this means to you, I have invited to our microphone tonight Congresswoman Lenore Sullivan of St. Louis.
Frank, as I told the House today, the coffee shortage has been a myth and a hoax. There has been no coffee shortage in terms of supply in the United States. The tremendous price increases have been based on anticipated shortages, beginning this coming July 1, when the new Brazilian crop starts to go to market. The facts are that the coffee supply this coming year will probably be at least as high as this year. And this year's supplies have been adequate. Now, what the president of Brazil apparently is trying to do is to put a floor under coffee prices at Brazil at the highest level that they have reached in a period of alleged shortage, because he knows that otherwise the price would have to drop because the shortage just doesn't exist. So he prohibits Brazilians from exporting coffee at less than that amount. This is certainly an attempt to hijack the consumer. The whole thing has been a fraud on the American consumer from the very beginning. And this action of the president of Brazil in trying to maintain the artificially high price by government decree is the finishing touch in exposing the myth about a coffee shortage. The United States government's official do-nothingness in this whole coffee situation since last January has cost the American people about $600 million a year in unnecessary, unwarranted, unmoral, dishonest price increases for an article so generally used in the American household.
Thank you very much, Congresswoman Lenore Sullivan of St. Louis. Chicago, Secretary of Agriculture Benson told an audience today that he intends to go ahead with his plans for selling tremendous amounts of government-owned butter in foreign countries at a much lower price than American housewives have to pay for butter. Mr. Benson said he had decided not to sell any of this butter back to the American taxpayers who bought it in the first place because, he said, it might disturb the market in this country. It will be interesting to see what President Eisenhower does about Mr. Benson's bargain butter for foreign countries, especially since the president said at a press conference some months ago that he was personally opposed to selling surplus foods overseas cheaper than they were selling in our own country. Anoka, Minnesota, one of the president's most ardent supporters, has now challenged Ike's farm policy. Senator Edward Thigh, Republican of Minnesota, demanded a continuance of the 90% price support program until the farm surplus problem has been solved. With the net worth of America's farmers down $10 billion in 15 months, Senator Thigh told his audience that switching to the Eisenhower-Benson flexible price support program would upset our national economy. Said the Minnesota Republican, "I will not be a party to the liquidation of the American farmer." New York City, a woman identified as Gertrude Wertheimer, wife of a high United Nations official, jumped to her death in the Hudson River from the George Washington Bridge. Her husband, critically ill with heart disease, was not informed. Roselle Park, New Jersey. McCarthy and Stevens will be married next Saturday. Ray Jenkins will be best man. Harry McCarthy will take Ann Stevens as his bride. Ray Jenkins of Newark will be the best man. If they're interested, I know where they can get three other parties by the same names and make it a double wedding. Capitol Hill. The Senate approved a housing bill of sorts today. Concisely stated, it provides considerable federal money for the builders and real estate promoters. It contained a couple of features which were described as devices to prevent recurrences of the FHA scandals. But the proposals would have to be enforced by the same FHA officials who have been sitting on the present scandals. In today's bill, the Senate included the president's request for a token program of public housing, only 35,000 dwellings per year, about 10% of the normal needs. Also approved was Senator Mike Monroney's proposal, which enables farmers to secure federal loans on their homes without having to put up the entire farm as collateral. With more than 5 million unemployed and with little prospects of improvement, the problem of adequate unemployment compensation is becoming increasingly important to the entire nation. Bills to improve and extend the unemployment compensation were introduced in both houses of Congress today. Here to give you a personal report is one of the sponsors, Representative Amy Forand, Democrat of Rhode Island.
On behalf of myself and 81 co-sponsors, I introduce today a bill to amend the unemployment compensation law so as to correct inadequacies in the present state laws by imposing additional standards which states would have to meet as a condition of employees getting credit against the federal unemployment tax. The new standards would become effective on July 1, 1955. This would allow sufficient time for the states to amend their laws so as to meet the new standards. Here are the highlights of the bill. It provides that the maximum primary benefits payable under state laws shall be not less than 66 2/3% of the state's average weekly wage. Subject to this maximum, each individual's primary benefits shall be not less than 50% of his weekly wage. Benefits shall be payable to all unemployed insured individuals for a period of not less than 39 weeks. An individual who is able to work and available for suitable work may be disqualified and deprived of benefits up to 4 weeks if, one, he leaves suitable employment without good cause, or two, he is discharged for misconduct connected with his work, or three, he refuses suitable work without good cause. A worker would be disqualified for benefits for any week that he is unemployed because of a strike at the plant where he usually works, but would receive unemployment compensation if the work stoppage was due to the failure or refusal of the employer to to conform to federal or state laws pertaining to collective bargaining, wages, hours, or conditions of work, or the employer's insistence on wages, hours, or other conditions of work less favorable than those prevailing locally for similar work.
Thank you very much, Representative Amy Forand of Rhode Island. A late dispatch says that two Marine Corps attack bombers have crashed somewhere in the Florida Everglades. Scores of rescue planes have been out looking for them. They have thus far sighted only one man on a life raft, and they have found two unopened parachutes. The Sky Raider bombers, which plunged into the Great Swamps, are believed to have been carrying four men on instrument training flights. At Devilback, Germany, the Army engineers had a routine assignment today. That was the construction of a pontoon bridge where they line up boats across the river and put a bridge flooring on it. Suddenly, a storm broke. Lightning flashed, killed two men, injured 17 others. Stargazer Special. If you have a telescope or even a powerful pair of binoculars, astronomer Frank Manning of New Orleans suggests that you might watch the moon. Several weeks ago, as you may recall, Mr. Manning reported that he had discovered a strange marking in the crater Piccolomini, a marking which he says was also confirmed by the astronomer at Tulane University, a Dr. Thompson. Says Mr. Manning, quote, "It is a straight black line, like a road of some sort, extending from the central peaks of the crater to the mountains which form the rim. This thing is real, and it is new. It could not have been caused by a meteor without the meteor having to pass entirely through those gigantic mountains, which would have been an impossibility. Please tell your listeners that the crater Piccolomini is in the southwest section of the moon. It is a small crater northwest of the great crater Tycho. On the nights of June 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th, says astronomer Manning, the light will be right for seeing this mark, whatever it may be." End quote. I talked to astronomers today who tell me that if such a mark can be located and photographed, it will be a sensational scientific development. Double talk on the Potomac, special for Alaska. The administration hopes to dump the Alaskan statehood bill, which was part of the GOP campaign promises. Republican Congressman A.L. Miller of Nebraska is chairman of a committee which produced a statehood bill that is now holed up in the Rules Committee. Mr. Miller endeavored to soften the inevitable blow today by issuing a statement which said that even if Alaska did get statehood now, it would be 2 years before they could use it and so forth. Therefore, there seems to be no reason to worry about it now. Telegram, and I quote, "Is the Rex Bell you mentioned last night the husband of Clara Bow, the former movie actress? Signed, Tom Duncan, brilliant economist, Washington, D.C. Dear Mr. Duncan, brilliant economist, the answer to your question is yes. The former Clara Bow and her husband Rex Bell live on a ranch near Las Vegas, Nevada. If a man answers, scram." Housewives Special. The Safeway grocery chain says it can't make any money handling coupons for the big soap companies. Safeway is asking Procter & Gamble to pay Safeway 2¾ cents per coupon. Why not cut the price of the soap that much instead of fiddling with the coupons? Coast to Coast. Discount houses are growing like wildfire, says a retail trade publication, selling at competitive prices well below the fair trade prices fixed by manufacturers. The discount houses are unloading nationally advertised merchandise, which franchise dealers dare not sell at a reduced price because of the fair trade law. One big Washington retailer said to me today, "Fixed prices cannot compete with free enterprise." Time's up. Good night, good news, and good luck.